Okay. So, I guess, can we start? Yeah? Christina, you're the boss? Yeah? Yeah, okay, that's good. Let's start. So, today's sutta is the Majjhima Nikaya 31. It's called the Chula Gosinga Sutta, which means basically the shorter discourse at Gosinga. Gosinga is a place name. So this is what that this sutta is called. Not sure exactly where Gosinga is, but somewhere in the Vajjian Republic. Vajjian Republic is to the north of the river Ganges, north of the Magadha, basically, that's where it's situated. And this particular sutta, again, the reason why I have chosen this sutta is because it's one of the suttas that we haven't done before here. So sometimes I just take the suttas that we haven't done before, which is nice, because sometimes you have your favorite suttas, but if you read those all the time, and that's all you do, then you often miss out on stuff that you have forgotten about and actually was there in other suttas. So sometimes it's nice just to pick almost a random sutta and then do that, because there's always things in there which are interesting in this sutta. It's always exciting stuff. So, so let's see what is exciting about this particular sutta. Well, the first thing which is interesting here is that there is another sutta later on in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is called the Upakilesa Sutta. And Upakilesa means like a defilement of the mind, so it's basically the sutta on defilements. And both of these suttas, the opening of them is actually exactly the same. And the opening is about the Buddha going to visit the three monks being Venerable Anuruddha, Venerable Kimbila, and Venerable Nandiya. And it's exactly the same for both of them. And that is interesting, because in one sutta, they are talking about what they did before their awakening, before their enlightenment. So they were still practicing and striving on the path. But in this sutta, they're talking about what happens after they have attained awakening, right? So there's obviously a time span between the suttas. Now, there's a time span between the suttas, so how come the introduction is exactly the same? How can the introduction be exactly the same when there's a time gap between them? And one of the things that you will see as we go through this is that when the Buddha arrives at this park where these three monks are staying, the park keeper, the person in charge of that park, he stops the Buddha and says, no, you can't get in here. You know, he doesn't recognize the Buddha, basically. So how can that be the case that, you know, he doesn't recognize him. And then sometime later, the Buddha comes again and he still doesn't recognize him. So this is how you can see that sometimes the material which actually surrounds the sutta, what you might call the narrative or the history behind, which is behind the actual teaching of the Buddha, that is often a little bit artificial. Well, not necessarily artificial, but it wasn't always perhaps remembered precisely. And they would just take a standard opening, and they would apply it to two different suttas in the same way, without really distinguishing properly between the two different occasions. And that is, again, it's just one of those things which is interesting, because it means that when we talk about the suttas, we talk about the word of the Buddha, what we're really talking about is actually the teaching of the Buddha. It's not so much the surrounding material, but actually what the Buddha himself taught. That is what we mean by the word of the Buddha. And you can see that the surrounding material is not as important, and for that you often find inconsistencies, more inconsistencies anyway, in that particular material. Okay. If you have any questions as you go along, please ask. And if you don't understand what I'm saying, just please let me know. Clarify. Yes, Pauline. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's what I mean by narrative. The narrative is like the introduction, right? The Buddha was living there and there, and then he met the monks, and, you know, they kind of sat down together, and then the Buddha said, and that's where it kind of starts, right? Yeah. So that's how it's structured. And it's interesting, in the if you look at in the Vinaya, the part of the Buddhist canon which talks about the discipline, or not the discipline, the training, if you like, of the monastics. There's a chapter in the Vinaya which is about the first council. The first council is where they all met together and they recited the suttas, right? Now, at that first council, the way it is described is that they would first ask, well, you know, say, this is, you know, recite the Brahmajala Sutta. And then they would ask, where did that take place? who was it with reference to? Who was the kind of person it was spoken to, right? So in other words, the reason they must have asked that was because that wasn't part of the sutta originally. So they asked, where was it? And then it became part of the sutta later on. So it's part of Buddhist history, this idea that the framing narrative or the historical material was added after the actual speech by the Buddha or whatever. That's kind of accepted in Buddhist history, so to speak. So it is secondary. Yes? That is actually quite significant, I think. The significance there, I might as well talk about it now, I suppose. But the significance, I think, is just that the Buddha was an ordinary monk, right? That's really the significance of that. They couldn't recognize him. He didn't stand out. You know, sometimes in the later commentaries, it says that the Buddha was three times the height of an ordinary person. If he really was three times the height of an ordinary person, which doesn't make any sense, but if that really was the case, he would have been, everybody in the whole of India would have known about this. And it would have been very obvious he was coming, if he was coming. Or you have this idea of the 32 marks of a great man. That's another thing which is mentioned in the sutta as the Mahapurisa Lakana. And again, if somebody had those marks, and some of them were quite strange, like a protrusion on the head, like an eyebrow which went all the way across, his hands, arms being very long, and all these kind of strange things, then, of course, people would have recognized him straight away, right? So the significance of the fact that the park keeper didn't recognize the Buddha was that he was an ordinary monk. And there's many, many other places in the sutta, as you can see that as well, that he must have been an ordinary monk. He would have exchanged a robe with another monk. Another place where somebody doesn't recognize him, he just takes it to be an ordinary monk. So there's a lot of arguments for that. It kind of undermines some of the mythology of the Buddha, which is kind of things that have come up later on, which obviously doesn't make sense. Okay, let's start on the sutta and see what happens. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Nadika in the brick house. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila were living at the park of the Gosinga Sala Tree Wood. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to the park of the Gosinga Sala Tree Wood. The park keeper saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and told him, "Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them." So here you have the Blessed One, first of all, living in Nadika in the brick house. This is one of the few references to bricks in the suttas. Usually there's very little reference to bricks there, certainly not for the monastic dwellings. So that is a little bit interesting in its own right. And then you have these three monks living together there, and they were obviously companions for a very, very long time. And that's why they started off, and then they all became arahants together, so to speak. And then the Buddha, he goes there. And again, that was what Lynn was just asking about. You know, he comes to the park. This is not really an ordinary park. It's called the Vanadaya. Vanadaya is more like a forest grove. And this was sal trees, forest grove sal trees. So it was more like a natural landscape in a sense than an artificial park. You know, what we today would call a park is much more artificial. This would be much more like a natural landscape in a sense. And so the Buddha comes there and then, "Don't enter the park, recluse or ascetic, samana." So it obviously has no idea who it is, right? Otherwise, he wouldn't have said that. There are these clansmen. These are the Kula Putta, the son of like a family. So these are kind of the, the families or the. These are kind of the establishment in ancient India. So this would have been a good family is often a translation of Kula. So the point here is that even if you came from a good background, you had an education, and you had enough wealth, you would still go forth. Because that's what the Buddha's teaching told you was the right thing to do, regardless of your material or social position in the world. And the interesting here, they are seeking their own good, right? Don't disturb them because they're seeking their own good. That's an interesting way of putting it. Often you would say that, well, they're seeking to save the whole world, you know, that's why you shouldn't disturb them. But it doesn't say that. They're actually seeking their own good. They're searching for their own awakening and for their own happiness. And that is why you shouldn't disturb them. It's an interesting little thing that, you know, searching for your own good actually has this kind of priority here. And it's quite different from how we often tend to look at things in the West. And it's different from the Bodhisattva ideal, right? Bodhisattva ideal is about helping everybody else. And then, you know, forget about yourself. It doesn't matter so much, but everybody else matters more. Here, seeking your own good is primary. And of course, these three monks, Anuruddha, Kimbrila, and Nandya, they are not known really for having given all that many teachings. Anuruddha gave some teachings, and it was quite common, at least for some monks and nuns as well, I presume, in those days, not to become teachers. They would just become arahants. And then they would kind of just, you know, sit in the woods and meditate and be peaceful and nice. And that was fine. That was perfectly okay. So maybe not ideal, even better if they teach, but actually it's not really required. And you will see later on in the sutta why it isn't required, why it isn't really necessary. Okay. So, the park keeper wants to keep the Buddha out, right? That's interesting. Yeah. So obviously, the Buddha didn't really stand out. Then the Venerable Anuruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, "Friend park keeper, do not keep the Blessed One out. It is our teacher, the Blessed One, who has come." Then the Venerable Anuruddha went to the Venerable Nandya and the Venerable Kimbrila and said, "Come out, Venerable Sirs, come out, our teacher, the Blessed One, has come." Then all three went to meet the Blessed One. One took his bowl and outer robe, one prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. Then those three Venerable Ones paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Blessed One said to them, "I hope you are all keeping well, Anuruddha. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food." So here you can see how monks would act in the presence of the Buddha, right? They would meet him, they would carry his bowl and robe, they would make a seat ready for him. This was kind of the appropriate etiquette to how to deal with your teacher in those days. But one thing that the Buddha they don't wash his feet. The Buddha washes his own feet. And this is quite interesting. This is throughout the suttas, the Buddha washes his own feet. And even in the present day, you actually find that sometimes lay people will wash the feet of monastics or monks. But the Buddha washes his own feet, right? That's interesting. So we have gone too far sometimes in the way we kind of, you know, treat putting people on a pedestal a little bit too much, because even the Buddha wasn't put on such a pedestal in those days. So that's fascinating here. And then the Buddha says, and this is what you often find in the suttas, that the Buddha starts off by saying, you know, by having a pleasant conversation with the people that he meets. And this is, you know, important, and it's interesting that even the Buddha did this. This is what we expect in the modern day. This is what you expect throughout history, that you have a pleasant conversation first. And even the Buddha does that. "I hope you are well, right? I hope you're comfortable. I hope you have no trouble getting alms food." A kind of basic kindness and compassion that you expect between people. So it's not about just talking Dhamma. It's about also just being friendly and nice. "We are keeping well, Blessed One. We are comfortable, and we are not having any trouble getting alms food. I hope, Anuruddha, that you are all living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." Certainly, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. So this is the ideal way of living together in the monastic life. Not just the monastic life, any life, of course, family life, Buddhist society life, any organization, society at large, is this idea of living together in concord, in harmony. It doesn't mean that you always agree with each other necessarily. Sometimes you have differences of opinions. But as it says in the suttas, when you meet together, you're in harmony, then you have a discussion, and then when you leave afterwards, you're in harmony again. In other words, you discuss in such a way that it doesn't lead to problems, disputes, and all this kind of thing. So, and this is actually quite important. It's one of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, which talks about the development of samadhi or meditation. And what it says there is that you, for samadhi to really be able to take off, you have to start off with this idea of harmony and being at ease with each other, having a kind of friendly attitude to each other. If you haven't got that, you won't be able to attain samadhi. Samadhi is based on the sense that you have this mutual appreciation. So it's actually very important. If you have too many arguments, then it leads to an unpleasant atmosphere in a group of people, right? If you're in a monastery and everyone's arguing with each other and you know, there's no friendliness, it's impossible to sit down and be peaceful afterwards. But when you feel that there's a sense of trust, a sense of goodwill, a sense of harmony, a sense that other people respect you and that you kind of everything is very smooth and nice, then meditation becomes possible. And that is just as true here for the Buddhist society as it is for a monastery, right? So it's one of the great things to develop also part of the Buddhist society or in family life or whatever it is, this idea of mutual appreciation and harmony. Blending like milk and water, right? This is the opposite of oil and water. Oil and water don't blend. They come, the oil just floats on top. Milk and water, they blend. And viewing each other with kindly eyes. Piya chakuhi sampasati or something like that. Piya means like dear, right? You're dear. You look at other people and you feel a sense of you are dear. They are dear to you. This is how you deal with other people. So this is one of the things that we should, I think, all Buddhists, we should try to live up to that kind of standard. So then the Buddha asks, but Anuruddha, how do you live in this way? Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life, the brahmacharya. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. So this shows you how you develop loving kindness to the people who are in your community. And one of the interesting things here, you will see that the loving kindness, it starts off with how you relate to the people around you. And how you relate to them is with a sense of appreciation, right, and gratitude. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me that I'm living with such companions in the holy life, right? This is how you start off. You start having an appreciation for these people. And that is when loving kindness becomes possible. You can't have loving kindness to people you don't appreciate. If you think, I hate this person, then you're not going to be able to have loving kindness for them. And this is, you know, this is one of the things that I try to do. I don't know if you come here on Friday night, and sometimes I like to sort of, you know, encourage that. You know, think about all these people around you, a part of this Buddhist society. Think about all the good qualities in these people. It's so easy to focus on the negative things, but there's so much goodness there, so much beautiful qualities and intentions and a way of living your life. And when you focus on that, you get a sense of appreciation for the people around you, right? this is kind of make a foundation for loving kindness to become possible. So you look at people in that way. You look at the good qualities in people, and then you have that foundation in place. You feel gratitude. Wow, how wonderful it is that I have such companions. Thank you for being my companions. And then when you have that feeling, then you can have loving kindness. It's not always easy to do, but it's something you can develop gradually over time. So that is good both for monasteries and also good for the Buddhist society or whoever. And then, of course, based on that, I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. And this is an important point, right? And sometimes when we think about metta or loving kindness, we think that it's about meditation practice. You sit down, may all beings be happy and well. But of course, the point is that to do that in the mind is actually quite difficult. But to do it in body, first of all, is much easier. So you act with kindness towards other people. This is much more easy to do than to do it mentally. And when you do that, when you act with kindness towards other people, it's like you are starting to change your... Just by doing that, you're changing your view of other people because you're forcing yourself to see the goodness when you do an act of kindness towards them. So it's part of the same thing. So even if you don't feel any metta, strong metta, or even any metta in your mind, you can still act with kindness. So this is like the beginning, right? First of all, you act with kindness. So you do things which are kind. You do little acts of service. You know, you hold the door open for somebody, or you just have a nice body language which gives this feeling that people can relax around you, and all those kind of things. And then that is already the beginning. That's important. And this, you find this kind of structure all the way through the suttas. Loving kindness through body comes first, both privately and openly, right? Both when you're around people, but also when in private as well. You still don't, you know, you don't sort of pretend to be very nice in public, and then in private you're really aggressive and angry. You know, you have this kindness all the time with you. You carry that with you throughout the day, wherever you are. And then verbally, same thing, right? Again, you are verbally kind. You use the four ways of right speech, right? Soft speaking softly, speaking in a way which goes to the heart, and all these kind of things, both openly and in privately. Maybe, I don't know how much you speak privately when you're by yourself, but sometimes they say that's a sign of madness. I'm not sure. And then lastly, of course, in the mind, mentally as well, you actually think about other people in kind ways as well. And all of these things are a training. They're not something you can just switch on like that, but you have to train yourself to be able to do these things. And then based on that, you think, why shouldn't I put aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do instead? And then you do that. And then you are like one in mind. In other words, they all have kind of this idea of loving kindness, right? They're all helping each other out. I think this is what it's meant here by one in mind. And they're all kind of acting together, so to speak. So that, I think that paragraph is very nice and very important. And this is one of the, remember, these are arahants, right? We will see that later on, that they actually are arahants. These are fully awakened beings. And this is how they act toward each other. So it obviously, this is the example that the awakened ones set, right? This is how they act. And then we try as best as we can to also live up to that example. Okay. The Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbala each spoke likewise, adding, "That is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." And the Buddha says, "Good, good, Anuruddha. I hope," and then he goes on, "I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." "Surely, Venerable Sir, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. But Anuruddha, how do you abide in this way?" Before I go on to that, I just want to have a little bit look at these words, diligent, ardent, and resolute, because they are obviously important words here. They are kind of the clues that we are talking about. And the word behind diligent here is appamada, which is, of course, one of these very basic words in Buddhism. And diligent is not really a very good translation behind apamada, because apamada means the opposite of being kind of, it's like being heedless, not being careful, not really thinking properly, not using yoni somana sikara, not actually reflecting properly on what you're doing here. That is what pamada means. You are like deluded, you are kind of intoxicated or whatever, you don't understand what you're doing here. Apamada is the opposite of that. So apamada means, and I think the best translation for apamada is heedfulness. It's not a, perhaps all that common a word in English, but once you get the idea what heedful means, it means like you're careful, right? You're thinking about something before you do actions. You are you reflect about things. That's what heedful means. And diligent in English usually means that you're working really hard. You know, that's what it usually means. You're kind of working, getting on with a job or whatever. That's not really what it means here. It has more of a sense of being careful, making sure that you are, moral and all these kind of things. So that is an important distinction there. And then the second word is ardent. Ardent is the Pali word, it's atapi. And atapi in the Pali basically seems to mean something like being energetic. So you are energetic. The word ardent is not necessarily a very clear word, but essentially being energetic. And the last word, resolute, this is pahitatta in Pali. Pahitatta is related to the word padana, the samma padana is the four right efforts. So this is related to the four right efforts. So what this means is that you're making an effort, you're exerting yourself. That's what paitatta basically means. So you are heedful, energetic, and exerting yourself. This is what this means. And this, of course, is something that you have to do all throughout the entire path, right? The entire path is about exerting yourself in the right way so as to move forward. And this is then how they reply to this, how they do this. Venerable Sir, this is how we do these things. As to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over, if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery, or drops it into water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots for of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty, takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of a hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. So this is basically shows you how these arahants live their life together, how they work together, how they kind of why everything is so, works very smoothly, because they have like a nice routine and everybody's helping out. But it is slightly unusual that this is what is meant by these words, heedful, energetic, and striving. Because usually the words for heedful, energetic, and striving, usually they refers to how you use your mind, right? Right effort, whether you think with loving kindness, that you kind of overcome the negative states of mind, that you practice meditation and satipatthana and all these things. That is the usual meaning of these words. And it's quite rare that it refers just to conduct in this way. And in fact, the Chinese version of this sutta, I think there are three Chinese versions of the suttas, and at least two of them, they place this paragraph at the very beginning, showing just how these monks live together. And it doesn't describe it as this is how they live heedful in this way. It's just a description of how they live their life together. And perhaps that is a more likely way of reading the sutta, because it is a little bit strange that this should be considered how you live rightly. Of course, this is great, but it's a little bit too preliminary to be called heedful, energetic, and putting in effort, striving. Anyway, just a quick look at what they are doing here. So I think most of this is fairly obvious. He throws it away where there is no greenery. Apaharita means where there is little greenery, quite literally. Often, greenery harita actually means where there are kind of crops, right? Where you grow things like vegetables or crops or cereals or something like that. That's often what it means. So you don't throw it away where people are growing things, like the fields or whatever. Either that or it just means where there's little greenery. It's not entirely clear what exactly it refers to. And also you drop it into water where there is no life, presumably to avoid destroying life. I don't think there is all that much to be said about this, perhaps. And this idea that you don't speak too much, right? And then every 5 days we sit down all night discussing the Dhamma. In the Chinese version it says either they discuss the Dhamma all night or they just sit in what they call a noble silence, which basically means practicing meditation together, possibly, you know, going into the jhanas and that sort of thing, because they're arahants. So that is how they abide heedful, energetic, and striving together. Okay. And then the Buddha says, good, good, Aniruddha, but while you abide thus, diligent or heedful, energetic, and striving, have you attained any superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding? So superhuman state, right? So here we are getting into the real thing, what Buddhism is all about. The superhuman state, the states that go beyond the ordinary human experience. So this is where the Buddha asked them, well, you know, have you actually attained anything really worthy of a monastic? And here Aniruddha answers as follows. Why not, Venerable Sir? Here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want quiet, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, we enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Venerable Sir, this is a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding which we have attained while abiding heedful, energetic, and striving. Okay, so this shows you what the idea of heedful, energetic, and striving ultimately is about. This is what the purpose of that is, to attain the jhanas, right? And straight away you know that the kind of effort required for that is a very subtle type of effort. The more deep your samadhi is, the more deep you go into meditation, the more subtle the effort has to be, because otherwise you're disturbing the meditation process. So that's an important thing to understand. It's not, when we talk about effort in Buddhism, often it's a very, very subtle affair. It's not some kind of powerful thing. It's just directing the mind in the right direction. That's very often all it means. Just directing it rightly. And then that's enough. So here we have the first jhana. Again, as always, what is so interesting about the suttas is how these jhanas are described, right? A superhuman state is the first thing. It's outside of the ordinary human experience. It's outside of the ordinary human realm. If you attain the jhanas regularly, you will not get reborn in the sensual world at all. You're beyond the human experience, a superhuman state, right? And again, it is the jhanas and the four stages of awakening. The stream entry up to Arahant, the Tevijas. The Tevijas are the recollection of past lives, the understanding of karma and awakening again. These are the things that are called superhuman states. So the jhanas are always classified together with awakening and the stages of awakening. And that shows you how profound these things are regarded, right? They are regarded there at the very pinnacle of what is the purpose of the Buddhist path. And for that reason, these things are obviously very, very special according to Buddhist understanding of the world. So superhuman states, right? The next one here is a very interesting one. The distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, right? Again, the jhana jhanas as something which is worthy of the noble ones. It's something that you expect of the noble ones. It's something, another way of translating that is that it is the knowledge and vision, a distinguished knowledge vision that makes you a noble one. That's another way of translating this. So this is what you expect of the noble ones. This is, in other words, again, it's a very high thing. It's related to the states of awakening directly. So very, you know, again, something very, very lofty and very high, these dhana states. But perhaps even more interesting, that is part of it, that this, you know, this is what you expect of the noble ones. But even more interesting here, and I only really discovered this morning when I was reading through this. I'd like to read through these suttas before I come here, so I'm a little bit prepared, so I don't kind of just ramble things off the cuff, so to speak. But what is interesting here is this idea of knowledge and vision, right? The jhanas are distinctions in knowledge and vision. And that is, I've read this kind of statement so many times before, but only this morning did I realize that actually is something very profound and very interesting. A jhana is a state, distinction in knowledge and vision. Ordinarily, knowledge and vision is something that we associate with insight and understanding. You have the yathābhūta ñāṇadarśana. And if you, I don't know if you remember this, but you have the gradual arising of the Buddhist path. You know, you have the idea of, you start off with sila, from sila comes the pamujja, the gladness, from mudra comes the piti, from the piti comes pasaddi, tranquility, from pasaddi comes the sukha, the happiness, from the sukha comes the samadhi, stillness of the mind, deep meditation, basically what we're talking about now, and from that comes the yatha bhuta jnana dasana, the knowledge and vision of things as they actually are. And of course, the knowledge and vision of things as they actually are in that context means insight. It means seeing reality. It means seeing dukkha, suffering. It means seeing impermanence, right? Anicca. It means seeing anatta, non-self. It means understanding the world in terms of the three characteristics. It's all about insight. And here, exactly the same term, jnanadasana, is used for the jhanas themselves. Right? Isn't that extraordinarily interesting? Normally we tend to divide, maybe I shouldn't say we, but it's very common in the Buddhist world to divide Buddhism into samatha and samadhi on the one hand, as if it is one path, and then the path of vipassana on the other hand. But here it is saying directly that the jhanas, the kind of the archetype for what is samatha, for what is samadhi, is jnanadasana, right? Isn't that kind of astonishing? I'm just amazed at how blind I can be, because I've been reading this for 20 years, and it never really, penny has never really dropped, but that's actually what it's saying. But these are states of insight. They are no different from insight. Once you get into the jhanas, the insight is there. And what that means is that, of course, to enter a jhana, you need very profound insight, knowledge and understanding. You need to see the world for what it actually is, even to be able to enter into the jhanas. And once you have been there, when you come out on the other side, you have even more knowledge and understanding as a consequence, right? The jhanas are kind of the source of understanding. And that's why they are mentioned in this way here. So what is it that you understand? Well, what you understand is that all the things that you left out before you entered jhana, all the things that you have left behind, they are dukkha compared to jhana, right? You understand that the whole sensory world, all those things that we ordinarily experience, they are suffering, they are a problem. That's what you understand. And you understand that you have attained something very profound and very deep, which is happiness. And suddenly, the whole world, which is concerned with the senses, with the body, and the whole, everything we know, basically, in our lives. What do we know in our lives? We know only the five senses, basically. We see, from the moment you wake up in the morning, you see stuff. You hear stuff. You feel things. You taste things, and you smell things. And that is our whole world. And for the first time, you understand that that whole world, everything that we normally experience, is suffering. You've reached a higher level. You're standing at the top of the mountain looking down upon something which actually is low in comparison. That's why the insight here is so profound. You understand the impermanence of that. A better translation than impermanence perhaps for anicca is unreliability. It's unreliable. The sensory world is unreliable. It comes and goes. You die. You have to give it all up. It's problematic. If you get into a jhana state, that happiness is much more reliable, at least as long as you can sustain that jhana state. It is much more reliable because it is an internal happiness that you have for yourself. So there's more sense of control and developing it for yourself than there's very little control with all the external things of the sensual world. But your inner happiness, there is some degree to which you can actually control that and be in charge of that. So this is the things you start to see, right? You start to understand the three characteristics. And this is what happens when you get into these jhana states. So jnana dasana and jhana are not separate. They come together. And of course, this is, if you know your Dhammapada, that famous Dhammapada verse, which says that there is no jhana without insight. There's no insight without jhana. Natti jhanang appanyasa. Natti jhanang. There's no jhana for one without wisdom. Natti jhanang appanyasa. Anyways, something like that. And then the next one, there's no insight without wisdom. There's no wisdom without insight. But for one who has both, they are in the presence of Nibbana, right? So they always go together. And this is, I think, one of the fundamental misunderstandings of many people in Buddhism, this idea that it's possible to divide Sammata and Vipassana, pull them apart, and somehow make them into different paths. They're not. They're one and the same path, always going together. It's such an important thing, and I'm not really sure how it is that we have got into this idea that these things can be separate somehow. Anyway, I thought that was very interesting when I read that this morning. It suddenly occurred to me how important that actually is. It never really occurred to me before. Okay, then it says it's a comfortable abiding, right? The first jhana is a comfortable abiding. It says that about all the subsequent jhanas as well. It's a bit of an understatement, isn't it? A comfortable abiding. It's like, and this is one of the things about the Buddha. When he says it's a comfortable abiding, he really means it is a comfortable abiding. It doesn't mean just a little bit comfortable. It means comfortable in a very profound sense. And that is important, again, for understanding the suttas. How do we interpret things when the Buddha uses words in this way? And the Buddha tends to use word in a very kind of absolute sense, in a very high sense. So when the Buddha says it's a comfortable abiding, he doesn't mean you're kind of chilling out in front of the TV or something like that, right? He means something much more than that. He means that you really have a very, very profound sense of well-being. And throughout the suttas, it's important to remember that. When the Buddha says that you have given up vitakka vichara, for example, here in the jhanas, it doesn't mean that you're just not thinking a lot. It means you really have given up all thought, right? The Buddha doesn't mince his words. It's not an understatement. And if anything, he understates things. It always has a very high meaning. So when he says that thoughts are given up, he really means that thoughts absolutely, completely have been given up. There's no kind of slight remainder or leftover there. It really is gone completely. And this helps you to understand, to interpret the suttas. And this is often a problem, that people don't see how strong some of these very simple statements actually are. And this is why it can be challenging for people to understand the suttas correctly, because you haven't got enough experience to really bring these things together. So, that is a comfortable abiding. So let's have a look at this jhana formula very briefly again, because it is quite important. It says here, whenever we want, yavad akankati or something like that, is the Pali. Let's have a look. Yava akankama, so as far to whatever extent we desire is what it means. So it's not clear that it means whenever we want, but it can mean how long we want, and it can mean many different things. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, right? Again, I always like to make the point that it means quiet here really means completely. It's the word eva, means completely. secluded, sensual pleasures really means the five senses. It's a plural for karma. It means the whole world of the five senses. So you are apart from, you are secluded from, you have left behind the world of the five senses. And remember again this idea that when the Buddha says that you have left behind the sensual pleasures, again, it means that in a very high sense, right? It doesn't mean, yeah, but there's a little bit left. It means it's gone. Otherwise, he wouldn't have used that expression. And this is exactly the same phrase you find in other languages, like the Chinese or the translations of the suttas has the same thing there. Secluded from unwholesome states, meaning the five hindrances, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought. And the meaning of that in this context, I'm not going to go into too much details now, but it basically means the last movement of the mind. In the next jhana, it's given up completely, so here it must refer to the very last movement of the mind that is left, the very last remnant of thinking, if you like. Yeah. And then you have the rapture and pleasure. This is the piti sukha, born of seclusion, vivekaja. So seclusion here means again seclusion from the senses, right? You have gone inside of yourself completely. Yeah. So that is the jhana formula. And this is what is this superhuman state. So for that reason, because it is called this kind of, has this incredibly lofty epithets, and it has this throughout the suttas, because it is the distinction worthy of the noble ones, is a superhuman state, you can assume that these things are very, very profound. And this is one of the reasons when you hear different people talking about the jhanas being interpreted in different ways, you can assume that the most profound interpretation, the interpretation which takes these things to be deep, is more likely to be correct, because they obviously are very special states. That is one way of deciding how what these things actually are. Yes? I think that's a good point. This idea of whenever, of Yavadeva Akankama, as far, basically, quite literally, it means as far as you want, as it means. And the meaning, as you say, seems to be that, you know, there is no striving there. There's no kind of, it's an easy thing, it's natural for them to enter these things. And I think this is exactly what's going on if you're an arahant, if you have no defilements of the mind. It is just, you know, automatic. You just close your eyes and just, boof, off you go, you know, into samadhi. Yeah. Sorry? Not really, because it's not a state. You can't operate, function in the world in that state. You know, if you saw somebody in jhana here, they would be like, sit like a rock, right? You would think they were dead, probably. Huh? You think, what's going on? This person looks like they're dead. And after 3 hours, you come back, they're still sitting like that, like a rock. And if you touch them, they don't know you're there, right? It's just you're talking about a completely different thing. You have basically left the world, pretty much. So it only lasts, because of the physical body and all the things, it only lasts so long, and then you come out again. So, yeah. Okay, so that is the first jhana, and that is the meanings of the words around that. Everybody happy? Does that make sense to everyone, what I'm saying? Yeah? Happy with that? Yeah? Okay, so then we move on, and... then the Buddha says, good, good, Anuruddha, but is there any other superhuman state, any other distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding, which you have attained by surmounting that abiding, by making that abiding subside? Why not, Venerable Sir? Here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, we enter upon and abide in the second jhana. With a fading away as well of rapture, we enter upon and abide in the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, we enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana. Venerable Sir, this is another superhuman state, distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding which we have attained by surmounting the preceding abiding, by making that abiding subside. So here you have the four jhanas. Everything is a bit contracted here, but some of the main aspects of the four jhanas are mentioned. So, for example, with the second jhana is with the stilling of vitakka vichara, right? And again, when you're talking about stilling here, as I said before, when the Buddha uses these words, he means it in an absolute sense. There's no messing around. It really means the complete stilling here. And that is why the second jhana is said to be rock solid, right? When in the second jhana, nothing moves. It's complete solid. It's completely solid state. When nothing happens for hour after hour after hour, you're just experiencing bliss, 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 bliss continuously for hour upon hour upon hour. It's hard to understand how that's possible. And you have no idea of the world. You have no idea of anything. All you do is just experience bliss. So that is what that is about. And then with the third jhana, I'm just going to go through this quickly. You're abandoning the rapture, you're abandoning some of that bliss, and you get an even more refined happiness. And this is where it says here, Sukkaṃ kāyena patisaṃvedeti is one of the descriptions of the third jhana. And that is often translated as experiencing happiness with the body. But what it means, and I think it's fairly clear in the sutta what it means is experiencing happiness directly. You have abandoned piti, that rapture aspect of happiness, and you have pure happiness remaining. Kayena, in other contexts, I think it's fairly obvious that it means a direct or immediate experience of happiness. Pure happiness. And this is the highest kind of happiness that is experienceable in terms of in terms of a pleasant mental feeling, is the highest type of pleasant mental feeling you can have of sukha in the whole universe, in the whole samsara, right, in all these realms or whatever. This is the highest. And once you go beyond that, once you go to the fourth jhana, all pleasant and unpleasant feelings subside and disappear. And all you have left is the adukkama sukha, neither happiness nor pleasure, pure equanimity of mind. That is what happens in the fourth jhana. And of course, the kind of the mysterious thing, and this is one of those things that I think you can probably only understand by experiencing these things, but the thing from the sutta point of view is that when you go to the fourth jhana, when you go to a state where there's no sukha, there's no happiness, there's no pain, there's certainly no happiness, and there's pure equanimity, and that pure equanimity, that pure evenness of mind is in a way even more pleasurable, even more happy than experiencing happiness, right? It sounds completely contradictory. How can equanimity, just a balance of mind, be more pleasant than a very, very strong and powerful feeling of happiness? How is that possible? That is what the Buddha says. This is how the path works. You come to a state of equanimity which is so profound, so peaceful, so utterly different from anything you have ever experienced before in your whole life, that it is better than even the highest happiness that is experienceable by a human being in the third jhana. This is why the Dhamma is so mind-blowing, right? And this is why it is so hard to understand, because you are going into experiences that are just of a completely different order from what we normally, normally understand in the ordinary world. And for that reason, sometimes you have to have a sense of confidence about these teachings, because you can't really get your head around, it's very hard to get your head around these things. Maybe a little bit you can, but you can't really understand these things until you're experiencing them yourself. So this is where the idea of saddha, of confidence, comes in Buddhism. You get saddha because you see that the path is leaning in that direction, so you can kind of extrapolate. You get saddha because you see other people having practice and they seem to have something profound, right? You get saddha because you read the teachings and the teachings seem to have a very powerful integrity to them. You get, you know, so all of these things kind of brings this sense of confidence up in you. But sometimes some degree of confidence is always necessary also in Buddhism. And sometimes I'm a bit surprised that people seem to think that the Buddhist path is all about kind of just, you know, investigating for yourself and all these things. Well, it is about investigating for yourself, but of course you can't investigate those things you haven't experienced yet. So there has to be confidence and investigation have to go together also on the Buddhist path. Anyway, I find that quite mind-blowing myself, and that's why I think it's quite interesting. So these are the four jhanas. Any questions about the four jhanas? Everybody happy with those? Yeah? Okay. So then the Buddha goes even further, right? He's going to push these monks all the way to the limit here. So he says, good, good, Anuruddha, but is there any other superhuman state, uttari manusadhamma, literally beyond the human state, which you have attained by surmounting that abiding, by making that abiding subside? Why not, Venerable Sir? Here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want, with the complete surmounting of the perception of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with a non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, we enter upon the abide in the base of infinite space. Venerable Sir, that is another superhuman state. A distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding which we have attained while abiding by surmounting the preceding abiding, by making that abiding subside. So here we are making the leap from the form realm into the formless realm, right? And this is why we talk about abandoning form. There is some aspect of the jhana, some aspect of that experience, which still has a residue of a form to it. Maybe the light in the mind or something like that, which is a residue from the form realm. And now we go beyond that. There's no form left at all. And you are aware, it says here, that space is infinite. I don't think that is, you are aware that space is infinite. It seems like space actually is infinite, and now you are aware of that. But actually, better way of translating perhaps is to say that you perceive that space is infinite. It's just a perception. It's a subjective experience. It's not a reality that you are aware of, which it might look like here. But you have the perception. Your internal perception is that space is bound without bounds, without limit. Again, you're not aware of something which actually goes on forever, because that's impossible to be aware of that. But you are aware that there is no bounds to space. It just kind of goes on forever. And that's all you have, right? That's all that's going on here. You are aware that space has no bounds. And that is even deeper. That is even more happy than the previous experience. Does that make sense? Why should the awareness that space has no bounds, why should that be more happy than experiencing the highest happy feeling that is possible in samsara? I don't know, that's what it says here. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's so different from how we normally think about things. It is so kind of, it is so such a different understanding of the world. But what it's saying is, when you have this incredibly simple perception of the world, very basic perception of the world, that there's no limit to space, that is a higher happiness than anything you had before. This is an even higher thing. You're surmounting the previous one, it says here, right? You're surmounting it. You've gone beyond it. You have achieved something which is even more happy in a certain way. So again, it is very hard to understand how that can be the case, unless you actually experience these things for yourself. Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, in all of these states here, you know, if something has come to a complete stop, there's no movement anymore. The sense of self has already subsided enormously. But you're right, with each step, there's even less, right? There's even less things for the self to hold on to. So, yeah. Eddie? Yeah? Yeah.
With a what?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 I think there's something to that. I think the idea is that if you have happiness, you are still fairly close to suffering, because happiness and suffering are opposed to each other. As long as there's happiness there, you're kind of still bound within that realm of happiness and suffering. And as long as you seek that happiness, there, you know, you also have the suffering as well. So the two tend to go together. But once you leave kind of all feeling behind, all you have is left is equanimity. It means that that whole world of feeling, it started to become unimportant. The whole idea of feeling things is starts to, you know, feeling doesn't have so much hold on you anymore. And that is a problem, because our whole life revolves around feelings. We want to experience pleasure. We want to experience happiness. We want to avoid suffering, right? And here you're actually moving into a realm where there's pure balance of mind, pure equanimity. And that whole world of trying to get feeling, happy feeling, starts to fade away and becomes irrelevant. You don't care about feeling so much anymore. And that is, of course, a very, very powerful insight, when you understand that all these feelings we're trying to get, actually, they're just problematic. There's something higher, which is even more, even better. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So let us move on, and we'll just go through the last parts of this probably a little bit more quick and see what happens. And then the Buddha says, is there any other superhuman state which you have attained by surmounting that one, by making that abiding subside? Why not, Venerable Sir? Here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want, by completely surmounting the base, or maybe the plane is better, the plane of infinite space, perceiving that consciousness is without limit, we enter upon and abide in the base of consciousness, unlimited consciousness. By completely surmounting the base of unlimited consciousness, perceiving that there is nothing, we enter upon and abide in the plane of nothingness. By completely surmounting the base of nothingness, we enter upon and abide in the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Venerable Sir, this is another superhuman state which we have attained by surmounting the preceding abiding, by making that abiding subside, right? So here you go from the perception that space has no limits to the perception that consciousness has no limits, right? And then you go from that to the perception that there is nothing, right? I don't know what that is. What does it mean to have the perception that there's nothing? You have a perception that there is nothing. That's what you have. So there is still something. There is the perception that there's nothing, but there isn't anything apart from that, right? It's weird, isn't it? It's very strange. It's very hard to understand what is really going on there. And this is why these things are so incredibly profound. And then you go beyond even that perception that there's nothing, and you go to the plane where there is neither perception nor non-perception. You don't even know whether you have perception anymore. But that thing is actually perception. The neither perception, non-perception is itself a perception. It's very, very, very profound. And so I'm not even going to try to explain what's going on, because I'm not sure if it is possible to really explain these things. I think probably what's there is probably the best one can do. The Buddha says, good, Anuruddha, but is there any other superhuman state, right? Even beyond this, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding which you have attained by surmounting that abiding, by making that abiding subside. Why not, Venerable Sir? Here, Venerable Sir, whenever we want, by completely surmounting the plane of neither perception nor non-perception, we enter upon and abide in the cessation of perception and feeling. And our asavas, pains, our defilements, our corruptions are destroyed by our seeing with wisdom. Venerable Sir, this is another superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding which we have attained by surmounting the preceding abiding, by making that abiding subside. And, Venerable Sir, we do not see any other comfortable abiding higher and more sublime than this one. Good, Anuruddha, there is no other comfortable abiding higher and more sublime than that one. So this is where things really kind of, again, are very hard to comprehend. The Buddha is saying that the highest happiness, the highest comfortable abiding, the most sublime abiding, is the abiding where all perception and all feeling comes to an end. Everything comes to an end. That is the highest happiness, right? It is, again, it's very, very hard to understand that. But this is what the Buddha says. And this is where you, again, you have to rely on a certain amount of confidence in the teachings to really understand what is going on. When everything comes to an end, then that's when you finally you're happy. But how can you be happy? You don't feel anything. Well, happiness is measured both in what you feel and also in those things where you don't feel. Wherever there is happiness, whether you feel or not, that is why it is the highest abiding. Highest happiness without feeling anything. That's what the Buddha says. Okay, so they were arahants at this point because the tains, the asavas are destroyed. So they have become arahants together with that entry upon the cessation of perception and feeling. Yes? That's what it sounds like, doesn't it? Yeah. So they have passed with the highest marks. So that's a good point. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. And then if it stops somewhere, then okay, this is how you continue. And if they go all the way, then okay, then it's fine. Yeah. Yes, God. Asavas. These are the asavas. Tains are the asavas. Well, the three kind of, these are the kind of often called the root defilements. So these are the kamasava, the asava of sensuality or sensual objects. The bhavasava, the corruption or taint of existence, right? The desire to exist, basically. And the last one is the avijjasava, the taint of avijja, you know, the often translated as ignorance, which I don't think is a very good translation, but the taint of delusion or of not seeing things clearly, of illusion, of you know, etc. Sometimes they also bring in the dittasava, but that seems to be a later development. So those are the three asavas. The root corruptions of the mind. Yeah. Okay. So now we are on the home stretch here of the sutta. And then, when the Blessed One had instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbala with the talk of the Dhamma, he rose from his seat and departed. After they had accompanied the Blessed One a little way and turned back again, the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbala asked the Venerable Anuruddha, "Have we ever reported to the Venerable Anuruddha that we have obtained those abidings and attainments that the Venerable Anuruddha in the Blessed One's presence ascribed to us up to the destruction of the asavas?" The Venerable Ones have never reported to me that they have obtained those abidings and attainments. Yet by encompassing the Venerable One's mind with my own mind, I know that they have obtained those abidings and attainments. And the deities have also reported it to me. These Venerable Ones have obtained those abidings and attainments. Then I declared it when directly questioned by the Blessed One. So, it's a little bit strange, this idea that the deities have declared it. That little statement does not exist in the Chinese version of the sutta. Because it's not clear to me how the deities would know. The deities are often just ordinary beings. They have their own defilements. So not sure how they would have known unless they were maybe some high Aryas themselves or whatever. No. Anyway, I don't take that particular statement perhaps with a little bit of a pinch of salt, but anyway. So the story continues. Then the spirit Diga Parajana went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and said, "It is a gain for the Vajjayans, Venerable Sir, a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, dwells among them and these three clansmen, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila." On hearing the exclamation of the spirit, Diga Parajana, the earth gods exclaim, "It is a gain for the Vajjayans, it is a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, dwells among them, and these three clansmen, the Venerable Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila." On hearing the exclamation of the earth gods of the heaven of the four great kings, the gods of the heaven of 33, the Yama gods, the gods of the twisted heaven, the gods who delight in creation, the gods who wield power over others' creations, the gods of Brahma's retinue, exclaim, "It is a gain for the Vajjayans, a great gain for the Vajjayan people, that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully awakened, dwells among them, and these three clansmen, the Venerables Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila." Thus, at that instant, at that moment, those Venerable Ones were known as far as the Brahma world. That is one of those stock passages you find in the suttas. Again, this is slightly more uncertain, this kind of thing. Sometimes these things have been added afterwards. I think in some of the Chinese suttas, that particular paragraph does not exist. Even though the spirit Diga Parajana came to the Buddha, that seems to be everywhere, but not this idea that it goes through all the heavenly realms. So perhaps a little bit more uncertainty around that than the rest of the sutta. But it's nice, everybody, rejoicing in the attainments of these monks. And then comes the last part here, very nice. The Buddha replies to Diga Parajana, "So it is, Diga." Diga means tall or long, right? So tall one, the tall Parajana. "So it is, Diga, so it is. And if the clan from which those three clansmen went forth from the home life into homelessness should remember them with confident heart, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of that clan for a long time." Right? This is what I was talking about at the very beginning. I was saying that sometimes you have these monks or nuns or anyone for that matter who they just become arahants and then they don't teach anyone or then they don't do anything. But here the Buddha says that all you have to do is if you remember somebody like that, somebody who was an arahant, and you remember that with a confident heart, with a heart of sadha, that is enough for that to be a long-lasting welfare and happiness of those people, right? The fact that you see somebody in the world who is an arahant, you understand that there is something higher in the world, and you gain confidence in that, because it means that your mind is inclining towards the Dhamma, is inclining towards something loftier, and at the very least, you will get a very good rebirth as a consequence of that, because your whole mental attitude is inclining in a good direction. So this is the power of having confidence in the right thing. And this is the power of right view, basically. You have right understanding of things. If you have confidence in the view that if you blow up yourself and many other people in one go, and that will make you go to heaven, that is wrong view. And that is, from a Buddhist point of view anyway, it's a wrong view. And that will lead to a lot of misery in the future because you're basing your actions on wrong view instead. Okay, and then not only is it good for them, for the clansmen and the family of those people, this is where, from this you get this idea that sometimes we have this idea in Buddhism that if a you know, a son or a daughter or a family goes forth, it's actually very good for the whole family, right? This thing you will often hear in Buddhist circles, and it comes from this kind of statement, right? That if somebody goes forth who is like in your family, it has a, can have a very strong impact on that family, especially if they have confidence in that. And then the Buddha goes on, and if the retinue of the clan from which those three clansmen went forth, the retinue is like all the people, all the workers and what have you, right? And friends perhaps as well. If the village from which they went forth, if the town from which they went forth, if the city from which they went forth, if the country from which those clansmen went forth from the home life into homelessness should remember them with a confident heart, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of that country for a long time. If all the Khatiyas, the noble ones, the Kshatriya caste, should remember those three clansmen with a confident heart. If all the Brahmins, all the merchants, all the workers should remember them with a confident heart, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of those workers for a long time. If the whole world, with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, its gods and its people, should remember those three clansmen with a confident heart, that would lead to the welfare and happiness of the world for a long time. See, Diga, how those three clansmen are practicing for the welfare and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good, the welfare and happiness of gods and humans. So, you don't have to teach even, right? Just by being an arahant, just by practicing in the right way, doing the right thing, that is enough for being for the welfare of humanity and everyone else. That's all you have to do. If you teach, it's even better. But you don't actually have to teach. And you are still not being selfish. You're still not kind of the selfish Hinayana or selfish Theravada. You are already practicing for everyone's happiness just by doing these things. And that shows you the power of arahantship, the power of awakening. When you see somebody who is awakened, when you come into their presence, you understand that something has happened. You understand, not necessarily, but those people who are ready and who have the right attitude and the right development of the mind, they will feel that there is something there. And that feeling will give rise to wholesome intentions and give rise to wholesome states of mind inside of you when you feel that. So just by being an arahant, just by being awakened, you're already doing something very positive for the world. If you teach on top of that, wonderful, but that is actually enough. So, from the Buddha's point of view, there's no such thing as a selfish arahant. It's impossible to be a selfish arahant. You're already a blessing for the world. That is what the Blessed One said. The spirit Diga Parajana was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's a beautiful, in my opinion, a very beautiful sutta. About, first of all, what I like the most about this sutta is just how the arahants live together, right? With metta, with kindness for each other, looking upon each other with kindly eyes, and having the sense of appreciation of each other, and based on that, they practice the metta. That, to me, is the most practical part of the sutta, which directly relates to us. Wonderful. The arahants practice in this way. We should be doing the same thing. Yeah. Okay. Any last questions? Anything else that anybody wants to say here? Everybody happy here? Yes, John. Yeah. Consciousness being infinite. I think the word infinite is probably not a good word, because the word in Pali literally means something like without limit. That is also the original meaning of infinite. It means not finite, basically, right? There's no boundary to it. So it is the idea that there's consciousness, but there's no boundary here. That's all you're aware of. You're aware of, instead of the previous one was like space. And then by developing that space more, when you have space, there's kind of consciousness which is aware of that space in a sense. But here you are actually taking away the space, and all that is left is just the consciousness itself being infinite, almost as if the consciousness fills that space in a sense that was there before. But the space, you no longer have that sense of space. Exactly what it means, it's impossible to say. Even if you had that experience, it probably would be possible to describe it, because you probably have to actually experience it yourself before you can understand what it means for consciousness to be. How is it different from space being unlimited, right? How exactly is it different? And it's very, very hard to say here. So, sometimes you just have to take it on confidence. There is such a state, right? Yeah. I have no doubt that these states exist personally, but it may not be necessarily obvious for people why they should exist. Yes, sir, we talk. Okay, I can repeat the question. What is the longest period that the noble one can stay in these states? They say that the longest period that you can stay in the cessation of perception of feeling is 7 days. That's kind of what they say. So that is for the ending of perception of feeling. So these ones here will be somewhat less than that, because they are lesser attainments, right? But it might well be. I mean, I hear people going into the jhana so many hours at the time. Go into deep jhana, I can stay there overnight, 10 hours perhaps. And these are even deeper states, so maybe even a day or two.
Because I would say. I read earlier that they meet once every 5 days.
Yes, yeah. So, but I, that's the max, 7 is the maximum, right? And I guess maybe not every 5 days, maybe occasionally they stay for 7 days and then they come out. So then, I don't know. Just guessing. But of course, the rebirth in those realms, that they last a very, very long time, right? And they're talking about thousands of eons in the rebirth of those realms. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else would like to say anything here? No more here? Everybody happy here? Yeah? Okay. So if that's the case, then we will just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we will call it a day.